Your conference is being recorded.
Good morning. This is Janet DeGeorge from Hands and Voices. We ask that all participants mute their call. We can hear some background noise. Thank you. We ask that you do not place us on hold, as that often creates music on our end. But otherwise, please put your phone on mute so that we can minimize background noise. Good morning, everyone. This is Janet DeGeorge from Hands and Voices. We want to welcome you to our monthly Our Children's Safety Project call. I'm going to now introduce our mentor and coach for this community of learners, Dr. Harold Johnson, who will be talking about our meeting here this morning. Harold?
Hi, thank you, Janet. I'm a proud Hands and Voices member and the co-director of the Our Children Project, along with Janet DeGeorge and Sarah Candy and several other individuals. We're very pleased today to have with us a guest, Dr. Michelle Rayana Bassis. Michelle is a mother, a teacher, a researcher, a professor, a leader, and a friend. Her title of the presentation today is A Radical Middle, How Professionals and Deaf Education Are Making a Commitment to Work Together, Working Better Together. I also will tell you that Michelle just, I think it was last week, co-hosted a Twitter-based discussion regarding the maltreatment of children with disabilities, so we thank you for that. And the information that we share with you about Dr. Bassis' presentation today, information was shared about the Radical Middle, which really is committed to framing a dialogue in the field of deaf education about truths, about beliefs, and finding the area in between people's beliefs to bridge those differences to establish, you know, a community learns as well, where the focus is upon effective collaboration and partnerships to move the field forward. Particularly, it's also about creating a safe place for an open and honest dialogue over issues that challenge the field in hopes of fostering trust. And the hope of the Radical Middle is to really to foster a cross-disciplinary resource that fosters collaboration. I would tell you, as someone who not too long ago retired from the field of deaf education, that the Radical Middle is composed of individuals such as Dr. Bass, who are fairly new, relatively new, like in the last, you know, 5 to 6 years to the field of deaf education as professors. They all graduate roughly around the same time, but they all share the same vision that we can bridge the differences, we can make a difference. And I will tell you, as someone, again, who has been in deaf education for quite a long time, they really are seen not only as the Radical Middle, but as a tremendous hope as to how we can bridge those differences that have historically divided us. So with that brief introduction, I would like, you know, to turn this over then to Dr. Rayana Bass so that she can talk with us about, you know, the Radical Middle, maybe also how this idea, this concept fits into our effort within Hands and Voices to enhance the safety and success of our children who are deaf and hard of hearing. So with that, Dr. Bass, please talk to us about yourself and about the work of the Radical Middle.
All right. Hi. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, very good. So I'm really happy to be here with everyone today, and I really appreciate this opportunity to discuss some of the work that we're doing at the Radical Middle. And so I guess I'll start with just a little bit of history of how all of this kind of got started. Several fellow doctoral students and I, when we were working on our doctoral studies, were part of a federal grant through the National Leadership Consortium on Sensory Disabilities. And through that federal grant, we had opportunities to collaborate where we might not have had, had we been doing our doctoral studies through independent funding or on our own. And so through that particular collaboration, several of us who came from very different backgrounds and perspectives in deaf education were kind of, for lack of a better word, forced to work together. And through our collaboration and through our work, we came to realize that our differences were actually fewer than our commonalities. And so through many, many talks and discussions and late nights and sometimes peers, we realized that our field has a little bit of pain in terms of how we work together, talk to each other, especially from an academic perspective. And we really wanted to make a commitment to make that better. And so what started as a small little group of us online committing to fostering productive discussion is actually kind of growing every day. And we've managed to establish an online community. I'm looking right now. We are at 928 members, comprised of a variety of professionals. We have teachers, we have interpreters, we have researchers, we have parents turned researchers. So we have a wide variety of people that are participating in conversation and talking about the research, talking about the big issues, but also at the same time making a commitment to being very reflective and cognizant about how we talk to one another. And so instead of coming to the table defensively or thinking that people are going to have to put up a fight to get their perspective across, we're really working on trying to talk about those things in more productive ways and in ways where we're listening to one another and hearing one another, again, for lack of a better word, instead of coming defensively, so that we can work through those things and realize the value that all these different perspectives bring, and that, you know, all of our kids don't identify one way or the other. We have so much diversity within our field, and that if we don't work together, we're really not doing our job. We really need to combine our efforts if we really want to move forward. So that's a little bit about our history and where we are now. So
That introduction is Harold Johnson. Is quite helpful, especially knowing that how large a group it is. In terms of Dr. Atabas, in terms of your current efforts that this group is working on, and again, maybe how this might overall relate to what Hands and Voices is trying doing with Our Children Project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so actually, several of our founding members are very passionate about the topic of preventing and helping children that have been in situations where they faced abuse or neglect. And so back in 2016, we actually hosted an online discussion board on the topic, and we had several of our moderators host that, and we have that archived, and I'm happy to share that with you all as well. But it brings forward a really important topic that we don't really talk about often. I don't recall in my own teacher preparation programs really having these discussions, and I know that they're difficult discussions to have. And so beyond that, we've all made commitments in our teacher preparation. Most of us are still working in teacher preparation programs to make a commitment to dedicate time to talk about these things with our upcoming pre-professional teachers. And so, you know, we've organized a variety of resources. I have, you know, a variety of resources that I use in my own classes as well. But this is not a topic that it doesn't matter what your philosophy is or what your ideals are in the field. This is a topic that's important to everyone. And so I personally have made a commitment that in every single class I teach, I dedicate at least one class session to discussing these issues and alerting students, especially in the deaf education program, to the efforts of the Our Children Project and where they can find resources and bright spots to help them in the instance that they need to report or in the instance that they need to get support for their students. In bringing this up further, too, with our board members, we are very excited to find some collaboration with Hands and Voices and others to create a webinar and a guided discussion on the topic and create a space on our webpage. We have currently a space on our webpage that's a call to action in support of the Our Children Project, but we'd like to expand that further and develop webinars and a resource page so that students or people can also be directed to where they can find additional resources, and that we can redirect folks from our pages over to the Hands and Voices page as well, so that we're supporting each other's efforts, if that makes any sense. So, but that's what we're looking to do and to support. And also too, just within advertising your monthly calls, I think, you know, it's really important for people to be aware that these exist. So helping with that effort too and disseminating that information of what's going on and where the conversations are around this topic.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I wondered, in terms of, you know, the overall issues that the Radical Middle has identified and is working to address, and what kind of fruits of your labor have you had so far?
You know, this has been a really difficult process from the beginning, and I think it's just because it's a very personal thing for a lot of people, you know, where they identify on the spectrum of philosophy and deaf education. But, you know, we have had some victories, and there have been some times where through, you know, our Facebook page, through private messenger, or from face-to-face conversations that I've had with folks at conferences where we've presented, or even through some of the threaded discussion that we've seen on some of the more hot topics, I would say, on our page, we're seeing slowly a shift in how people really talk to each other, and a shift in the words that we use, and a shift in asking questions instead of making, you know, definitive statements or making assumptions about where people are coming from. And I think what's really beautiful about that is we're, you know, especially some of our members that have been with us for a longer time, we've had quite an influx in the last year, but definitely amongst our more towards the original members, we see a shift in the way that they're talking, a shift in the way that they're framing how they're approaching conversations. And it's fostering actually really lovely conversation and conversation from a place of understanding. You know, there's also some groups too that while they're very stuck in the middle are often underrepresented. So, you know, we have folks on there that are discussing issues behind unilateral hearing loss and issues behind folks that use cued speech and folks that are very, very, like they identify as very, very hard of hearing, and so they don't really seem like, they don't feel like they fit in either world. And this has also unintentionally created a space for folks in those areas to have a voice and to participate in the larger conversation as well. And so that's been a really nice thing that we've seen over the last several years as well. When we talk at conferences and we have face-to-face discussions from folks too, we see a lot of the emotion that comes behind a lot of this work, you know, and this is still, you know, being Radical Middle is difficult even for many of us that have promised to do this for a long period of time and have made this commitment, because there are still, you know, depending on who you talk to, we find that we come across people that do have a very rigid perspective, and sometimes people can be very difficult to get your idea across or have a productive conversation. And so part of that too is learning strategies on how to do that. And coming up pretty soon, as soon as we're in the process of getting a discussion board organized, but several weeks ago on NPR, they featured the TED Radio Hour featured some talks about how folks can have productive discussion and some tools and strategies for that. So as we grow and as we have more difficult conversations, we're going to be framing this and giving our members tools for fostering positive and productive discussion with people that may have very opposing views as well. So within the whole conversation, we've seen a slow change, and so we feel that now it's kind of a nice time to say, okay, now that we see people that look at this area as a place that they can be trusted, and this is a safe kind of place, so we don't allow folks to call out individuals, for example, or we help to reframe the conversation as moderators to make sure that if we have issues, that we're talking about the issues and not the person or a group of people or a particular organization, and to move towards the issues and how to solve that. And as we've grown to that part in our development, we're seeing a space now for actually having formal discussion on the actual skills and tools that we can apply to these conversations so that we can take it a step further.
Thank you. 924 members, roughly. That's huge, especially for Philadelphia Ed, which is frequently difficult to get people to come together. Certainly, you know, the discussion boards you have, you know, the Twitters, you know, the various things. I've always been struck by how much great expertise are out there among teachers and parents and other educators, professionals. So much knowledge. Have you been able to tap into that and to literally or figuratively give voice to such expertise? And if so, then what are some of the wisdoms that you guys have been pulling or finding or discovering as you communicate with this very large and growing community of learners?
Yeah, so one of the things that is just really something that I value about this community of learners is that, you know, we do on occasion get some criticism like this should just be a professional group, you know, and but part of being a professional group is also listening to the needs of teachers and parents and members of the deaf community and all of, you know, we have to listen to all of these voices in order to understand what we do in a better way. And so the beauty of folks from all of those different perspectives participating in the conversation has been really beneficial, especially to me as a professional. I did spend 10 years in the classroom setting, and, you know, I'm a little bit removed now from what I call the front lines. And so on occasion, too, when a teacher comes on and they talk about some of the issues from their perspectives, it kind of reminds me about, yes, we can talk about a lot of these things in theory, but then again, too, it's very important to understand how they affect practice and what is actually going on in classrooms and how we can use what we know and what we have to help support teachers and parents as well. And we have quite a few parents turn professional or turn researcher on our page as well, and so their perspectives are also highly valuable because they not only have now the educational expertise, but they have the lived experience of what it's like to be a parent and going through the process of, okay, my child is deaf, and now what do I do? And all of the trials and tribulations of getting the correct services and the correct support and framing that from a research perspective. And I think in any field, but I know that we talk about this a lot in deaf education, is we do have like a research to practice gap, but we also have like a research to community gap in a sense too. And so some of these conversations have brought to light some of the areas where we do need to find a better way to bridge what we know theoretically and we know through the research into practical solutions for our teachers, for our parents, and for the deaf community as well. I've had a lot of really rich one-on-one conversations, too, with parents and with other professionals about the struggles that they've had to deal with, especially if their parents turn professional. And understanding their perspective and understanding their experience has been very enlightening to me as a professional as well. I will fully admit that when I started my professional journey, technically I would say back in 2000 is when I was officially credited to be called a professional in deaf education. You know, I came with a very grounded view in bilingual education, and I was very rigid in that view. And, you know, through my experiences as a teacher in the classroom, that did evolve. But where it really did open my eyes and where I really did evolve was through my conversations with parents and when I really was able to take a step back and see everything from their perspective, and that's been very illuminating to me as a professional, and I would definitely say that I can speak on behalf of the members of our board as well, as that's been an important piece of this conversation.
That research to practice gap that you talked about is, of course, true in many fields, but in deaf ed, it seems like, you know, we believe a lot but don't necessarily know a lot. There was not too long ago a large federal grant that was given under the auspices of Dr. Susan Easterbrook to really kind of get at what do we know, what do we need to know, and more importantly, how do we actually enhance the literacy of kids with deaf and hard of hearing? Has your group been able to bridge that research effort to strategies that the teachers and parents, you know, can use to enhance the literacy skills of their kids?
So I know that a lot of the work that Dr. Easterbrooks has done, and she's actually even, I believe, has been, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but partnered with Georgia Pathways, and I know they've done a lot to disseminate some of that information. From our perspective, we have not specifically focused on evidence-based practice because, well, many of what we do in deaf education doesn't have an evidence-based practice. But through Dr. Easterbrook's work, there have been strategies and curriculum and things that have now finally had an evidence base due to replication and due to very deep study. And so part of our initiative for the next year, for the upcoming year in 2018, is to host monthly moderated discussion on the work that's actually currently being done. And so across our board, we have a variety of levels of expertise, and some of those folks on our board have been directly involved with the work that's been done through the grant that was procured through Dr. Easterbrook's work. And so we hope to, now that we've had some of those hard conversations about, okay, modality and educational placement and law and that sort of thing, is to shift more to a focus on what works, what do we need to focus on, where do we need to clarify. Another part of our efforts, too, is to develop resources that can be found online that kind of, for, you know, like a research brief, for example, on specific strategies that are either evidence-based or best practices, identified best practices in the field as well. And so that's part of our upcoming work. But what's been a challenge is that the 10 of us on the board all do this as a volunteer basis, and we're all fairly new professionals in terms of working in academia, and so we have pretty interesting professional lives outside of this. So we're kind of like SOFA warriors, if you will, and so we spend a lot of our volunteer time trying to organize this content and trying to disseminate this information and moderate these conversations. So we don't always move as fast as we would like on some of these things, but it's definitely, there are definitely things in the work, and we're just taking it step by step as we grow and we move forward.
This is Harold again. The one thing I always find difficult when I go to professional conferences or part of online discussions or web pages is, okay, this is all good information, but what can I do tomorrow, either in my classroom or in my home, with my child, with my student, to improve their learning opportunities, to enhance their performance. Thus far into this process, and as well as your own professional career, both as a teacher and researcher, now as a professor, are there any kind of takeaways or stuff I could do tomorrow in my home or classroom that you can kind of share with us?
With regards to, are you talking on the area of literacy and language, or are you talking about just fostering those productive conversations with maybe other professionals?
I think, you know, really, Harold again, I think really in terms of literacy, but I think really the whole thing as far as, you know, kids learning opportunities and their performance. So literacy would be great. Maltreatment topics, prevention of, would be great. But I'm opening it up a bit more just in a sense of, as you guys are working to establish this community of learners and you're gathering and sharing information, have mm-hmm. there been any so far takeaways that you might suggest that parents and educators could use tomorrow or, you know, next day in their classes with their kids?
Yeah, sure. So one of the things, I'm going to jump on my website real fast because we have a resource there that I think I have found important. And I did had the opportunity to talk with a lot of teachers actually last year, almost exactly a year ago in the state of Michigan. And one of the things that we talked about, I have to apologize for a second because I'm scrolling through some of these things. But some of the things that we focus on are, how do we have better or more productive professional communication across a child's educational time in school? And so I was at a conference last week, and Dr. Stacy Tucci was actually one of the keynote presenters for this conference. And one of the things she talked about was a continuous cycle of care. And so that's one of the things that we are also kind of broken up into when we're thinking about bridging things together, research to practice. But we also are missing some bridges within practice as well. So some of the examples she shared in her presentation were, early interventionist audiologist doesn't fully understand what is happening at the school level. And, at the school level, the teachers don't fully understand what transitioning out into real-world situations kind of looks like. And so part of what we do at the Radical Middle is not only to bridge folks from different perspectives, but it's also to kind of understand what all the little different pieces of our field do and how to make better transitions between and across those stages of a child's identification, early intervention, schooling, and then transitioning out of school. And so on our Radical Middle page, one of the things that we have is a little handout called How to Be Radical. And part of that is to also bridge those conversations with people that you wouldn't normally talk to. And so we presented last year this challenge for a room of professionals in deaf education in the state of Michigan, and they ranged from anywhere from audiologists to teachers to SLPs to itinerants to early ed folks. And so we had quite a mix. But we found that when we framed their discussion with these, tips or points, they were able to ask questions that they had not normally asked one another and to learn what everybody's role in the field was. And so I think that's an important thing for teachers is to, we deal with audiologists, we deal with SLPs, we deal with, if we're working in a self-contained area, if we're itinerant and we're working with general ed teachers, sometimes we don't have those deep conversations to understand what's going on. And so part of that is to make time for those conversations and to ask the right questions. And so one of the things that we ask our members to do is to view the field from different perspectives and experiences and not to compromise your knowledge base or belief system, and to also have open and honest judgment and free dialogue with folks that may be a professional counterpart or a philosophical counterpart, and to make a pact to work together for the sake of students. So that's some of the points that we have on our handout. And so we found that through those conversations, teachers could maybe see benefits that the educational audiologist might have that they didn't really understand or know before. And so one of those things that we can take away as professionals is to make a commitment to really truly understand the role of those service providers that you're working with on a daily basis, and make a commitment to say, hey, let's have a conversation about what your role is and what your goals are beyond what we would talk about at an IEP meeting, for example. But, do you understand what I do on a day-to-day basis, and do I understand what you do on a day-to-day basis? And I think having that understanding will help us support our students better in our classroom so that we can support each other's efforts for helping our kids in the classroom.
Thank you. This is Harold again. And for everyone, I'll be opening up the Q&A for everyone in just a moment, so it won't be just me asking questions. I wonder, since so many of our teachers now are itinerant, they're like the only one in maybe their whole school district, working with kids with deaf or hearing, but they don't have that critical mass anymore, people that they can talk and share with. Certainly the Radical Middle provides such a forum, but are there other ways that you guys are developing or have already found that teachers and parents who otherwise are isolated, can both ask questions and share ideas and be recognized for the expertise that they have?
Yeah, so we definitely foster that where we can on our page. And so members do have the opportunity to post content for discussion. And posts are moderated, and there are some rules to follow in terms of making posts. But we have had multiple posts for folks looking for resources. And I'm going to see if I can find one off the top of my head here while I'm looking through. But, we'll have parents come out and say, this is happening with a student, or this is happening in my classroom, or these are, the resources that I'm struggling with. Does anybody have any knowledge or resources or a contact? And so we see that type of discussion happening on our page as well, where folks can get information from other professionals that they may not have had a contact with. And so definitely, I tell my students, I say, if you're not working in a school for the deaf, you likely do not have a strong community of practice locally. And so you have to seek out those opportunities in other places. And there are definitely Facebook groups for teachers of the deaf, and I know that the Deaf Ed chats every month, and what you folks are doing every month is one way to get that information. But here we take a little bit more of an unstructured approach. So, for example, I'm looking at one right now where one of our members posted, I'd appreciate thoughts from the group about something that I've been thinking for a while. Do you agree that eligibility determination for deaf education support should not be based on audiological thresholds and language and scores alone? And so, and the comment goes on a little bit. And so we had a nice rich discussion about, oh, well, this is what we do in our district, or these are some of the things that we've done in our state. And so we've kind of expanded that community of practice, or that critical mass for folks that don't normally have that. Here in the state of Florida, for certain, we have a lot of itinerant teachers. And so we do have state organizations that do provide support and webinars and information. But what's really missing in some of those resources is the actual conversation component. Just sitting down and having a discussion with someone and hashing things out that way. And so the Facebook forum has been a really nice way for some folks to do that as well, and maybe get some perspective and idea in a less formal setting.
Thank you. Two more questions for me, and then I'm open up to everyone else on the group.
Okay.
One of the things in our work in terms of maltreatment is that, you know, certainly we're working to recognize and report, but more importantly to prevent, you know, the maltreatment of kids with exceptionalities, particularly those who are deaf and hard of hearing. But also we know that we can't stop at all. And one of the things that we're becoming increasingly knowledgeable or wanting to know more about is the whole concept of trauma-informed practices. That is, how do you work with kids that have experienced trauma in a way that doesn't re-traumatize them or doesn't recognize, you know, what they have gone through, and then gives them additional strategies of handling, you know, that trauma? Is this topic one that has emerged as an area of discussion or a possible focus for the Radical Middle?
We have not had that topic emerge at this point. In our previous guided discussion on the topic, it was mostly built around resources. And I think part of that, too, is that this is a very difficult topic for a lot of folks to talk about. And I think people, too, are not aware of what the actual implications for some of these actions are on children. And so they feel like, oh, well, they've been rehabilitated, or they're seeing a counselor, and that's enough. And I think that's a mistake, because as professionals, we really, these hurts and these pains that these children are facing, especially if they are victims, is something that carries over, and it affects their academic performance, it affects their socialization, it affects their relationships with people. But I don't know that we do have enough resources. And so that particular topic has not come up in conversation, but it's definitely one that needs to be talked about. I know that that was one of the questions, too, that was posed on the Deaf Ed chat last week. And I remember viewing that question and going, gee, you know, I really don't know specifically to children who are deaf or hard of hearing. I mean, we certainly have some research out there that focuses on the wider population, but I wonder what is specifically different, or how we need to approach these things differently with children who are deaf or hard of hearing. And so I think that would be a very important discussion to include as well. Yeah.
Thank you. This is Harold. Yeah, this is the topic that the Our Children Project is exploring in more mm-hmm. in-depth, and we have done recently several resources that we're going to be tapping into. And it really,
right.
It's a lot of it's evolved around simply recognizing that certain things that happen in a kid's life can cause a trigger to remind them of something else that happened, a trauma. And then their initial reaction, that flight or fight, for example, that's kind of what they have. And so giving the kids additional strategies to deal with these triggers, but also then giving educators and parents additional knowledge so that when a kid does have a problem and they do, quote-unquote, act out, that they aren't mm-hmm. simply blamed for being a bad kid or there's something wrong with the kid, as opposed to they've had something in their life that triggers My last question to you before I turn over to the group to ask questions is this as you talked about, this is a difficult topic, the maltreatment of kids mm-hmm. with deaf and hard of hearing. And,
yeah.
and as we talk about in our children project, our goal really is not simply to focus upon the bad, the dark, you know, the ugly, mm-hmm. but rather to go towards the light, you know, that helping our kids to be empowered and to be safe because they are empowered and knowledgeable and they have the strategies. But one problem that a lot of parents have faced is that when they raise this topic in IEP meetings particularly, they're getting a lot of pushback from professionals that that's not really something appropriate to talk about IEP meeting. We don't really have the resources, the training, the support to talk about this. So how would you suggest that parents and professionals raise the topic of child maltreatment in an IEP meeting in such a way that gets buy-in to figuring out how we can help kids to be safe and successful as opposed to pushback?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, part of it, I think, starts in teacher preparation, and that if we really demonstrate for our students how important this particular topic is and really to give it a lot of weight, I think that if we can instill that in our teachers that are coming up, that will be one step in the process. So part of that, you know, is educating our teachers and how important this topic is. But I think above and beyond that, I think just the statistics alone are enough to really show that this is something that needs to be discussed. Trying to pull up a conversation here that I had with someone. You know, the statistics are just staggering, and the statistics are scary, and we know that our children in deaf education or children that have disabilities in general are more likely to be abused than children that do not have disabilities. Beyond that, too, the numbers are just very heartbreaking as well. And so I think, you know, this is something that's very important. With children who are deaf or hard of hearing, too, they need to have the language. They need to have the conversational tools to know how to tell people something is going on or how to tell someone, no, stop, this is not what I want. And I think part of that is something that needs to be discussed as part of an IEP meeting. Yeah, we talk about language. We talk about, you know, communication strategies. Well, part of that is teaching our students how to communicate to make themselves safe, to advocate for themselves, but also teaching students what language is important, you know, what words, how do we describe these things, how do we explain to someone that this is happening to them, because many of our students, too, sometimes they're stuck in a situation where the person that is their primary, the person that is their voice or the person that is communicating for them could be the abuser or could be someone that would know the abuser, and they're afraid to go beyond that net of, or that network of people that, you know, that they're in tune to. And so, yeah, absolutely, parents should say that, you know, this is part of their language goals, part of their language goals for advocating for self, part of their language goals for being safe, part of their language goals for understanding how to express something that's so complex. And so, absolutely. And I have some resources, too, that I can share as well that I have online with regards to what parents can do and what teachers can do to advocate for those types of goals and language strategies that can be used with children just in general.
Thank you. Yeah, one statistic that actually Janet frequently, you know, cites is that on the average, children tell eight different adults before they're believed that they have in fact experienced maltreatment. And the vast majority of time, actually, kids don't tell adults, they tell another kid. Given all that, I've been asking lots of questions as a way of kind of interviewing Dr. Boss. I wonder, at this point, we're opening it up for questions from the audience. I would ask that you would state your name for the captioner and then to ask your question. And then we'll give this a few minutes and see what kind of questions are out there. So what questions would you guys like to ask our presenter?
This is Janet DeGeorge from Hands and Voices. Thank you so much for this presentation. I cannot tell you how hopeful your organization, the Radical Middle, creates in us as a community of parents at Hands and Voices. We're so grateful to the work that you're doing. And I think you probably answered my question in the last bit of conversation, and that is one of the projects we've been doing here on the Our Children's Safety Project is to encourage the use of an IEP, IFSP safety checklist. Mm-hmm. And we have found that there is sometimes resistance to having this conversation in an IEP meeting. So I have no doubt that all the students that are going through your program who are able to connect this conversation in their pre-service work to maybe a moment at an IEP meeting where a family brings it up, they would be more open and willing to discuss it. But do you have any other suggestions for us as parents when we go to IEP meetings and bring this up as a topic and find resistance? Any strategies we can use?
Yeah, well, first, too, if you know if you're going to anticipate some resistance, find a professional. You know, I always tell my students, too, even when they're far done with their teacher preparation work and they're out in the field, if they need an ally or if they need someone to provide support, that I'm that person. And, you know, they can give me a call or send me an email. And if they need someone that maybe has a little bit more clout, if you will, you know, I could say, hey, you know, these are important things and here's the research to back it up. You know, I think the IFSP is very, very useful, and I think that is definitely something that would be helpful in guiding those discussions. I wonder, too, if, you know, having these meetings before kind of giving the teacher heads up, by the way, I'm going to probably be talking about some of these things as well, and I'd like your support on that and maybe fostering some of those discussions, too. I know that sometimes it can be difficult to have before the IEP meeting, because the teachers are very busy and they usually have a lot on their caseload, but maybe saying, you know, what are your thoughts on this area? What is the school's policy on this area? What is the school doing to support students with this information? And sometimes, too, getting the school counselor on board if you have someone that's very supportive. But I definitely think, you know, again, the Radical Middle, at least on the Facebook page, is a good way to connect with professionals that you might not necessarily have access to. And I think, you know, reaching out and say, hey, I'm having this meeting at my school and I think I'm going to get some resistance. Is there anybody out here that can support me through that? And I mean, I've supported parents on even in other states on other issues. You know, I know that I'm going to get resistance on fill in the blank, sign language interpreter or an FM system or whatever. And so sometimes having that professional on your side and in your camp, even if it's just through a written statement or, you know, some resources or even, you know, participating on phone, I'm sure a lot of professionals would be willing to do that. I know I would be willing to do that. And so definitely reaching out to getting some backup from folks in the field, I think could be helpful as well.
This is Janet. Thank you. Those are great suggestions.
And Janet, this is Harold. And for everyone on the call, we are working with the Council for Exceptional Children about their support for the inclusion of safety statements in the IFSPs and safety checklists and IEPs. Actually, there's a meeting in 2 hours about this. So far, 10 of the 17 divisions in a CEC, and the divisions cover all the areas of special ed from gifted to the inclusion of art and education, and certainly also as far as DEF. So far, 10 have voted to formally support the inclusion of this information into IFSPs and IEPs. We hope to have additional ones within the next couple of weeks. I'll simply say is that we will shortly be revising the safety document that was sent out and is noted on our page, so that when you go to these meetings, it won't just be four organizations, it'll be 14 different organizations from throughout the country that support this. So it's not just going to be you, it's going to be all these other agencies and organizations, particularly the field of special education, said this is important. So more help is on the way. Other questions that people would like to ask our presenter today?
Hello, this is Raina Otala from Louisiana Hands and Voices. I have a question about cycle of care. I love the idea, but we have a shortage of providers, shortage of teachers of the deaf, shortage of educational audiologists. So how can we bring this model to our schools, not schools of the deaf, if we have shortage of providers that we're looking forward to work with? At the same time, how can we, in a smaller level, I'm trying to bring this cycle of care from year to year, from Once kids finish first grade, then the second grade teacher has no idea what happened first grade. So my thinking was we need something ongoing from grade level to grade level within that school first before we expand it outside. So what would you recommend?
That's, you know, a very difficult issue, and I think it's a very common issue. At one time, too, in the beginning years of my teaching career, I worked in a very similar situation where I was pretty much the newest person hired in the district, and then I was also the expert in the district because there were so few people that were available. And so I agree, and you kind of answered part of your question, I think, a little bit within your own question, is that first it has to happen at the school level. So whomever are the professionals that are working at the school with the children need to have a better way of formulating some kind of discussion and keeping each other informed. And again, I know itinerant teachers have huge caseloads, and so this can be very difficult. And so, you know, if we look to the greater picture, this is likely something that needs to be, you know, a policy or a district-wide decision where we say we are going to provide these providers with enough time to be able to have these conversations. But a lot of it, too, comes down to just education. So, you know, we also find, too, that, you know, itinerant teachers are working with students in a school, and the teacher that has this child in their classroom has no idea how to deal with a deaf child. They have a very basic working knowledge of what the services are for that child, even within the administration as well. And so it really kind of comes down to the teacher of the deaf has to kind of be a little bit of a fighter, too, and say, you know what, no, this is what we need and this is what is appropriate for this child. I highly commend the efforts that CEC is doing, and I think as soon as we start getting more concrete things in place, you know, this is our framework, this is the curriculum, this is the law that we are going to pass to ensure things are going to happen, that we'll slowly see these things fall in place. But until then, it kind of needs to be a bottom-up approach, and I think that's kind of, you know, what we found even too in building a community of practice around, you know, philosophical unity, is that it has to be a bottom-up approach. So it's going to start with the teacher and maybe even the parent in some cases too. And it's exhausting work, but it's something that has to be done. And I think the more that they're informed and the more that they see that there needs to be a commitment to that collaboration, the better. Beyond that, too, is trying to find or establish larger community of practice beyond your school or even beyond your district. And I know, like, within districts, within states, and even at the national level, there are communities of practice for teachers and educational interpreters and the like. But, you know, finding ways to bridge through there, too, to get advice from other professionals and to say, well, this is what's happening in my district. What support services should I be asking for? What support services are even available? And that it's just kind of that process. But I wish I had the solution. I really do. You know, we are a critical shortage field. We are a low incidence field. And so that makes our work much more challenging. I tell my students all the time, I said, your job is 10 times harder than a regular teacher. Because not only do you have to be an excellent teacher, you have to be an excellent user of language, and you also have to be a fighter for your kids. And so you're constantly educating people about what's needed. You know, it may be in the perfect world, there could be a resource or a place where people could go to get all of that information, but, you know, we do have that information scattered about in various organizations. I know DCDD has done a lot of great work through CEC and other organizations as well. And so maybe finding like a one-stop shop for teachers would be a helpful thing as well. But, you know, definitely it's a bottom-up thing. And it's a commitment on the teacher's behalf to say, I am going to commit to reach out to these people. And if these people don't exist, I'm going to find one in another district so that I can get the correct information I need to support the child.
Michelle, this is Harold. There actually is maybe another resource or two I can share with you guys. The National Association of State Directors of Special Education, NASDE, N-A-S-D-E, National Association of State Directors of Special Education, is just about to release their new guidelines for the education of students with deaf and hard of hearing. And those guidelines are meant to be at a state level to do what really we're talking about here today, which is to foster collaboration, enhance learning opportunities, and improve performance. So you might want to go to the National Association of State Directors of Special Education and look for their document that they are just now going to be releasing very shortly about how to enhance deaf education around the country. The other is that on the deaf education website, www.deafed.net, you will find a great deal of resources that will be of help to you, as well as a radical middle. I think we have time for one more question, and then we'll begin wrapping up today's presentation. So is there one more question someone would like to ask?
My name is Christy, and I just have a comment to add to what you guys were just discussing. I am a deaf and hard of hearing teacher from the state of Wisconsin, and we are actually lucky in the area of collaboration. Annually, we hold a professional and family statewide conference just for deaf and hard of hearing and deafblind families. Another way we reach out is we have a Google Plus community for all of us teachers in the state of Wisconsin where we can go on and collaborate about some of these other topics that you guys talk about. It's just something to maybe get you guys started, starting with the districts around you and expanding from there. Just some positive insight that it's being done in other parts of the nation.
This is Harold. That's a great resource. I'm sorry. Thank you for that. And maybe if you could send a link to that to Janet DeGeorge, that would be helpful. Although we do know Anna Paulson, who I think is the one that you're working with there in Wisconsin. And Michigan's also developing such resources. I'm sorry, Michelle.
I was going to add to that Georgia Pathways is another one of those resources. So it seems like states are taking the initiative to make sure that they have these resources in place. Now that these state resources are starting to emerge, it would be really nice to see like a national cooperation of all of these places as well. But I know that Georgia Pathways is another one, and Stacey Tucci is the coordinator and contact for that as well. And she's looking even to develop their model and replicate it in other states as well. So if you're working in a state that doesn't have these resources, so reach out to the folks that have commented so far. But Georgia Pathways is also another organization that you can reach out to see if you can get some of these supports put in place in your state as well. So,
thank you very much. Well, I'd first like to thank our presenter for both the information and for stimulating the discussion we had here today. And also then I'd like to turn over to Sarah Candy, who's going to bring the call to a close. Okay, maybe I misspoke there. Go ahead.
This is Janet. Sarah, are you on mute? Can you try again? Well, maybe we've lost Sarah somehow. So I just want to, I'll go ahead and just walk us through our last few minutes together today. One of our traditions here at Hands and Voices is to end our time by saying what we have done this last month I have, and this next month I will. We understand that the growth in our community has come over time in everyone's really, really busy lives. And so, but we want to keep taking what we're learning and create actionable measures within our own communities nationally and internationally as well. And so I'll start, and then I'll just open it up. For those of you who are committee members who've been around for a while, you know how this goes. So this last month, I decided to do something simple, which is to wear a bracelet every day, one of those small rubber bracelets, and it says end child abuse on it, and it has the 1-800-4-A-CHILD phone number on it. It's there to both remind me of my commitment to this project as well as just what actually it has occurred is some conversation openers by wearing it. And in fact, this past week, a young woman disclosed some abuse she had experienced as a child, which opened a conversation, which I am hopeful will lead towards healing and empowerment for her. So this month, I will If anyone emails me at janet@handsonvoices.org, I will mail you a bracelet and you can join me in this as well. Who else has something they'd like to share about what they've been doing around this project?
Hi, this is Christine from Washington State. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah,
okay.
Go ahead.
I too have done something relatively simple. I think we've had a lot of opportunities to share about our Hands and Voices and Guide Buyers program. And thanks to Michigan, we have a bubble slide and Michigan Hands and Voices. And I wanted to say that we put on one of those bubbles our children safety project and have that opportunity to share with anyone who will listen about what the Our Children safety project is for families and children. So we have some other opportunities that will continue sharing that information as well. And I would love a bracelet, so I'll email you. Thank you.
This is Janet. Thanks, Christine. Anybody else want to share?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, this is Michelle Niehaus from Kentucky's Division of Behavioral Health, and I found this a wonderful call and very timely for us, both in the education perspective and also in looking at trauma-informed care and mental health. One thing that I've done in the past month is to look at our Exceptional Children's Conference on a statewide basis, and we'll be co-presenting with the school social worker at the School for the Deaf on trauma-informed care for teachers to start that ball rolling. And one thing I will do is to email Harold and see if he may be interested in helping bring more information from this project to Kentucky at our System of Care Conference, because we are really trying to bring together all deaf service providers, whether it's from the education perspective, from mental health, from child protection. And I think that this is the kind of unifying information that we've been looking for. So I thank you so much for this opportunity.
This is Jana. Thank you so much. That's fantastic. We have time for one more.
This is Sarah Kennedy. I'm so sorry I dropped off the call when I went off mute and speaker. So sorry about that. I am committing to sharing the safety statement with 6 organizations this month, and we'll let you know what happens. I did also want to share that Cresta Brinkman, who's on captioning, she couldn't call into the call, wanted to announce that the Look Club is looking at the book Wonder, and they will have their meeting on the first Tuesday of the month, so that's December 5th.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll put that in a minute. That's a 1 o'clock Mountain Time call with a Zoom meeting.
Great. This is Janet. For those of you who found out about this call today through a forwarded email, maybe through the flyer, if you would like direct information sent about our monthly calls, including the minutes, which will include the information that Sarah just mentioned, please email me at Janet, J-A-N-E-T, at handsandvoices.org, and we will add you to the list. We get together monthly. We often work on projects together. We believe that we have the power and collective might to create a difference in children's lives who are deaf or hard of hearing. Don't ever think that the work that you're doing is too small. We started this project almost 10 years ago with the question, what if I have a conversation with one person, child? So we want to put yourself on mute. Thank you. Anyway, we want to invite you to be a part of our community if you're not so far. We're so grateful for our presenter today and the conversation and facilitation by Harold. And thank you, Michelle, again for being with us here today. We look forward at Hands and Voices to collaborating with you at the Radical Middle. For those of you who else would like to be a part of our community, please join It's as simple as that, and just email again at janet@handsonvoices.org, and we'll make sure that you're on the list. With that, I'm just going to turn it over to Harold, who has a final comment for us today.
It's actually it's a quote that's attributed to Mahatma Gandhi, and the quote goes as follows. It is the action, not the fruit of the action, that's important. You have to do the right thing. It may not be in your power, it may not be in your time, that there will be fruit. But that doesn't mean that you stop doing the right thing. You may never know what the results come from your action, but if you do nothing, there will be no results. Stay the course.
Mm. Thank you, Harold. And with that, we want to thank all of you for participating and being a part of this experience today. Have a great day, and we look forward to hearing from you. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.